Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. I'm James Menendez. And coming up a little later, we will have more on that developing story out of Munich. A car's been driven into a crowd, injuring nearly 30 people, some seriously. We'll go live to Germany in less than 15 minutes. But we are going to start with what looks like a major shake-up of the transatlantic alliance established in the wake of the Second World War. A shake-up that's left European countries reeling today and scrambling to work out how to respond. And it all turns on President Trump's announcement on Wednesday that negotiations with Russia to end the war in Ukraine had already begun, with a long phone call to Vladimir Putin, and that neither Ukraine nor America's European allies would have a place at the table. Speaking in the Oval Office, Mr. Trump said he hoped to end the war as soon as possible.
I think we're on the way to getting peace. I think President Putin wants peace and President Zelensky wants peace and I want peace. I just want to see people stop getting killed. We're very far away from that particular war, but that's a vicious war. Probably 1.5 million soldiers killed in a short period of time. I've never seen anything. I have pictures that are, you wouldn't believe it, and it would be nice to end it immediately.
The bilateral approach to negotiations with Russia has drawn an angry response from European leaders. Six countries put out a statement last night saying that Europe and Ukraine must be included in talks. The German government also accused the Trump administration of giving ground on things like territory and NATO membership before negotiations had properly begun. Here's Britain's Defence Secretary John Healey speaking ahead of a meeting of NATO defence ministers in Brussels.
My message in these discussions will be that there can be no negotiation about Ukraine without Ukraine, and Ukraine's voice must be at the heart of any talks.
Also at that meeting is the new US Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, who denied that America's plans meant abandoning Ukraine.
No country, as the President Trump has pointed out, has made a larger commitment to the Ukrainian mission than the United States of America, north of $300 billion. So the United States has invested in stabilizing those front lines after the aggression of Russia. There is no betrayal there. There is a recognition that the whole world and the United States is invested and interested in peace, a negotiated peace.
Well, let's get some reaction from one of those European Union and NATO countries not included in the negotiations. Margus Tsahkna is the foreign minister of Estonia, one of the three Baltic states that sit on Europe's front line with Russia. What's his reaction to the suggestion of peace talks not involving Ukrainians nor Europeans?
There cannot be the justful and long-lasting peace in Ukraine without Ukraine and also without Europe, because Putin has not changed the goals, and we can call them like root causes, as Putin said himself. And the root causes were not actually to gain some more territories in Ukraine, but it was much more. He has said publicly many times that the historical disaster was the collapse of Soviet Union. He wants to restore that. So we are not only talking about the situation in Ukraine, but we are talking about the European security architecture. And in this regard, there cannot be any solutions without Europe and Ukraine.
So what does it say about the transatlantic alliance then that Donald Trump is prepared to cut out Europeans and cut out Ukraine from these peace talks?
Now, this is something we cannot agree. And this is something I cannot agree as well as a foreign minister of Estonia, that why we need, or President Trump needs, to weaken the positions even before the official talks are going to start with Putin. The other way around, we must push Putin to the corner. We must push Putin to the weak position, and we have all these opportunities. And the idea of Putin is actually what he didn't gain on the battlefield within the last 3 years. He wants to now gain during the talks or negotiations, and we cannot let him to achieve that. I'm just very clear that the last call from President Trump, not coordinated with allies as well, it didn't put us and Ukraine in a stronger position.
Do you think then that Donald Trump is not an honest broker when it comes to this issue?
I think that we have a long way to go, and based on the same fact that actually Putin is enjoining to bring us or President Trump into negotiations when he is having the upper hand and also declaring the goals.
What about security guarantees? The U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said that he couldn't imagine Ukraine becoming part of NATO. I mean, would you rather that they were part of NATO, or at least that that process was begun during these negotiations? Is that the only security guarantee that will deter President Putin, in your view?
We have been very straightforward position, and I'll stand on that position, that the most efficient and long-term working security guarantee for Ukraine, but also for the Europe, is actually the full membership of NATO, because NATO is working and it has a structure and the real capabilities. But I understand as well the practical position and situation in the political field. So what we need to do in Europe to negotiate and also to prepare about what kind of working security guarantees we can give to Ukraine and for us as well. But it means as well that we need to put the real initiative in. Also, we need to do it together with US and Ukraine, and not to do it bilaterally with President Putin, because we are talking about working security guarantees, military security guarantees to Ukraine.
To that extent, is Donald Trump right that Europe should be stepping up and taking responsibility for what happens in Ukraine?
I'm absolutely sure that Europe must do more, and I have been on that position already years. We need to invest more heavily to our capabilities, to our defense, and also we need to understand that no one else is coming and will come to solve our problems. But if we talk about the real security guarantees, if you're talking about how can we push Putin back, this is not the only European problem. This is a global problem. We see the North Korean troops fighting in the middle of the Europe. We see China, who is enabling actually Russia waging this war economically. We see Iran, who is actually supporting militarily Russian war machine. So this is a global thing, and we need to work together.
Well, let me ask you this finally, Minister. If a peace deal is struck in Ukraine, and we don't obviously know what that might look like, but if that was struck and President Putin did feel emboldened, do you think that NATO, and in particular the United States, given that it's the most important member of NATO, would come to your rescue if Vladimir Putin decided to move into Estonia?
In that point, I am absolutely sure that NATO will stand together with US and the other way around. I just had a visit to Washington the end of the last week, and I didn't see any hesitation about that the other way around. But now we are talking about Ukraine, and also our message has been clear to President Trump and his administration. It is not only the question about how can we support Ukraine. It's about the question about European security architecture, and most of these countries are the members of NATO as well. So I'm sure this transatlantic bond is strong.
But for the last 3 years, we've heard from your country and also your neighbours, Latvia and Lithuania. They've said, look, if we don't stop President Putin in Ukraine, he'll come for us next. So are you feeling more vulnerable today?
I think that everybody in Europe must feel more vulnerable if we are not stopping Putin's aggression. And I'm not talking about ceasefire. I'm talking about how can we remove the willingness of aggression or restoration of Soviet empire in the meaning. And it's not about the Baltic states or Finland or Poland. It's about us all. It will be more costful to deal with that later than now.
Estonia's Foreign Minister Margus Tsukna. Well, let's get some reaction from Ukraine to all of this. Andrei Zagorodnyuk was the country's defence minister from 2019 to 2020. Does he feel betrayed by the United States?
Not yet, but we have some warning signs and red flags. We're watching, you know, extremely anxiously. Let's put it this way.
One big red flag is the fact that Ukraine is not due to take part in these negotiations. Yes. With Russia. What do you think about that?
That mustn't be acceptable. That shouldn't happen, because clearly Russia is extremely manipulative negotiator. They will try to say whatever Trumps want to hear. They say they want to stop the war. We're extremely for that. But the thing is that if Ukraine loses and Russia wins, certainly that's not going to stop the war.
Do you think that the United States has already given away too much before talks have begun properly? We heard on Wednesday from the new US Defense Secretary that he thought NATO membership for Ukraine was unrealistic, and he said also that it was unrealistic for Ukraine to expect that its sovereignty would be restored to the pre-2014 borders. In other words, that it would get back all of its territory.
It's just not going to happen, because Ukraine is not going to concede the territories officially, because that will actually make the situation extremely worse. because that will embolden Russia to move further. Because they will say, okay, great, we are like actually gaining territories officially.
What security guarantees do you think Ukraine would find acceptable short of NATO membership?
It all should be based on the concept of deterrence by denial. So essentially that means that Ukraine has to either have or have in a close proximity capabilities which are enough to turn the new potential campaign of Russia against Ukraine into disaster for Russia. So if Ukraine has those capabilities or they have them access to them, the Russia may consider this as a deterrent, and as such, they will not move on.
What sort of things, though? Because, I mean, you know, NATO countries have been sending huge amounts of weapons and equipment over the past 3 years, and it doesn't seem to have deterred Russia at all.
Well, firstly, it deterred Russia from moving further. However, from the future campaigns, certainly we should be talking about some powerful capabilities, including air power, because right now, Ukraine still doesn't have a single competitive plane against Russia.
And the US has said that it doesn't see any US troops or forces as being part of those security guarantees. It wants Europe to take responsibility. Do you think European countries, just taking that example of air power, will then do that and provide Ukraine with the fighters it needs to control the airspace?
That is currently being discussed. Well, I've just been to Brussels last week, met the European Parliament Committee on Defense, European Commission, etc. They clearly understand the risks. They understand that this is a risk not just for Ukraine, but for the whole Europe. And they are determined to do something about that.
So in that sense, things aren't so bleak for Ukraine. Donald Trump is just stating the obvious about the war, and Europe seems willing to step in. So, I mean, he's got it about right, hasn't he, Mr. Trump?
Well, there are serious consequences for Europe, because clearly, like, the most important one is that the new Secretary of Defense of the United States mentioned that European security is no longer a prime concern. That's a huge deviation from the policy which started right after World War II. So right after World War II, until yesterday, it's been very clear that United States considered European stability as its key strategic objective. Right now, he said it's no longer the case. If that is actually a policy statement, if that is actually true, Europe needs to reinvent its own security architecture. And that includes Ukraine, because clearly the instability would come from Russia through Ukraine. This eastern frontier of Europe needs to be protected. And if US steps away, then Europe needs to do it by itself.
So it really is a new era, a new world order,
absolutely.
Is it?
Absolutely. If these statements, which we have heard, are actually indicators of the new policy, then yes, it's a new era of European security architecture, and perhaps even the global one.
Andrei Zagorodnyuk, former Ukrainian defense minister. We'll have more on this story later in the program. We'll be hearing from our Russia editor in Moscow in about 15 minutes. You're listening to NewsHour. Still to come on the programme, the ancient wonder uncovered by archaeologists beneath an office block in London's financial centre.
We've opened up a test pit or a test trench in the basement of this room. Yes, there's a filing cabinet right next to us. But you can see a huge chunk of Roman masonry. It's absolutely fantastic.
More on that coming up in a few minutes' time. Let's just recap our main headlines this hour. Senior figures in Europe have accused President Trump of making unnecessary concessions to Russia ahead of peace talks on Ukraine. A man has driven a car into a crowd of pedestrians in the German city of Munich. We'll have more details on that in just a moment. And a breakthrough has been reported in talks to get the Gaza ceasefire deal back on track. This is James Menendez with NewsHour live from the BBC. Well, let's head to Germany now, in the city of Munich, soon to play host to a major international security conference this weekend. Because earlier today, a car drove into a crowd of people taking part in a trade union rally there. At least 28 people have been injured. Speaking to reporters at the scene, the Bavarian leader, Markus Söder, described his shock at what had happened and added that more action was needed to prevent such attacks taking place.
We will clarify all the details, but we react cautiously to every attack like this. But I can also tell you that our determination is growing. This is not the first case, and who knows what else will happen. It is now even more important that, in addition to the processing of individual cases, in addition to the concern that we all feel, and in addition to the sympathy and the great hope that many will recover, we also show the determination that something must change in Germany.
Well, let's go live to Berlin and talk to the BBC's Damian McGuinness. What more can you tell us about what happened, first of all?
Well, we've been getting more information from officials. It seems that a beige Mini Cooper was driving along behind this walking demonstration, which was surrounded by police cars, and it overtook the police car behind the demonstration and then swerved, sped up and drove right into the crowd. Officials say that at least 28 have been injured, and some of them critically. So it is a major incident, and the area has been cordoned off, and now police are calling for any eyewitnesses to come forward, because, of course, the big question is, why did he do this? Now, we know more also about the suspect. He is a 24-year-old Afghan asylum seeker whose application for asylum was rejected, but he was legally in Germany under a certain sort of status, which was quite a precarious status, but certainly he was legally here. Why he did this, though, we still don't know. There's no actual confirmation about the motive.
We heard Marcus Söder there saying that this wasn't the first case, and there have been a series of attacks, haven't there, in recent weeks and months. We've got elections around the corner. Is all this having an impact on the campaign?
Yes, it's really sparked a fierce debate here in Germany about migration. There was, of course, a large attack in Magdeburg in a Christmas market there just before Christmas, where hundreds of people were injured. And that, interestingly, did not really change the election campaign. At that point, mainstream political leaders really tried to calm people's fears. The far-right AfD staged rallies, and they called on borders to be closed. That was all. This attack was also carried out by someone who had in the past been an asylum seeker, although he'd worked as a doctor and had been in Germany for a long time. But there was an attack in January in Aschaffenburg, which was committed by an asylum seeker. That was brutal. In that attack, it was committed on a group of kindergarten children. A child died. A passerby who tried to help also died. And that really shocked the nation. And that was the point at which the Conservatives went really hard line on migration and made it a major topic in the election campaign. And since then, it's really dominated the debates here. Many people have said, to a detrimental extent, and you know, there's a risk of stigmatising anyone with a migrant background. But either way, I think what we can say is this further incident now, today, will certainly play into that already ferocious debate over migration.
Damian, thank you very much indeed. The BBC's Damian McGuinness joining us live there from Berlin. There is a live page up and running on our website on this story. As Damian pointed out, details coming in all the time. It's bbc.com/news. Now, the basement of an office in London's financial district doesn't seem like the obvious candidate for a major archaeological discovery, but that's exactly where what's been described as one of the most important pieces of Roman history has just been unearthed. Archaeologists have uncovered a substantial piece of the ancient city's first basilica, a 2,000-year-old building where major political, economic and administrative decisions were made. Our science editor Rebecca Morell has been given exclusive access to the site. She was shown around by Sophie Jackson from the Museum of London Archaeology team.
Sophie, we've just come down to the basement where this amazing discovery has been found. Are you going to take us in to see
it? Yes, please come down the corridor. Follow me.
I mean, it's funny because we're still very much in the basement of a building. There's carpet on the floor, there's filing cabinets in here.
But then you come into this room and it's quite different. We've opened up a test pit or a test trench in the basement of this room. Yes, there's a filing cabinet right next to us. But you can see a huge chunk of Roman masonry. It's absolutely fantastic. And what we're actually looking at is the south nave wall of the first Roman basilica, which was the first town hall built in London. And it's a hugely significant building.
So the wall that we're looking at now is just a little tiny speck of it?
Yes, this is a tiny fragment. The original building was 40 metres long, about 20 metres wide, and probably about 12 metres high. So it would have been a really, really big, imposing building within Roman London.
And have you always known that this is here when you sort of dug the test pit? Is this what you were sort of hoping to find?
We were hoping to find fragments of it. It's been known, more and more information about this building has been gathered over the last 50, 60 years, really. It's been pieced together and identified as this first town hall. But we didn't know that there'd be this much of it surviving. We thought there'd be a few fragments, and we're absolutely amazed and thrilled that there's so much of it here.
And in the next room as well, you've got a bit more, haven't you? Because it kind of goes through, there's a wall at the end of the pit, but you know that the old wall, the Roman wall, goes through.
Yeah, it carries on, so we know it's at least 10 or 15 metres long, and then we think it carries on out underneath the walls of the building out into Gracechurch Street, so a nice chunk of it survives.
How significant is this find? I mean, what sort of place would this have been?
This is so significant. This is the heart of Roman London, it's the heart of commerce. This building, the Basilica, was the administrative centre of London, administrative and political centre, really. So it's a bit like in 2,000 years' time, somebody dug up the House of Commons and found Speaker's Chair. You know, that's what we're looking at. This site and this building will tell us so much about the origins of London, why London grew, why it was chosen as the provincial capital, all sorts. It's just amazing, amazing.
The Basilica and the Forum complex, I mean, what would it have been, sort of a very busy place? Who would have been here? What would have been going on?
Well, the Basilica was the town hall, and then in front of it was a big open market square with ranges of sort of shops and offices around the outside. And it's a space where there would have been a market square, but also festivals and great speeches would have been given there. It's likely that the Forum Square would have had, you know, statues to Roman gods and important emperors and that sort of thing. But it's the place you came really to do business, and it's the place you came to get your court case sorted out. And it's where laws were made, and it's where decisions were made about London, but also about the rest of the country.
And the corner that we're sort of in here, or this part of the wall, is a really important part of the Basilica building.
Yes, just behind us, just to the north of us, is the what's called the tribunal. We think that's where the tribunal was anyway. And that was a raised platform on which the magistrates sat and made decisions, adjudicated on court cases, sorted out planning permissions, you know, the Roman equivalent of. It's a really, really significant part of the building.
I mean, some people would be surprised that we're standing in the bottom of a building, in the basement of a building in the centre of London, and here's a bit of Rome, but there's a lot in London. So.
Yeah, it's amazing. This pit actually is just like a window into Roman London, and there are so many spaces in London and our other cities where you can lift up the basement floor and find something amazing, and it's just such a great connection. It's really fantastic for people to be able to see this, because I think archaeology makes a great physical connection, and it's sort of living, you know, makes history come alive.
And that was Sophie Jackson of the Museum of London talking there to our science editor Rebecca Morell about that discovery in the City of London. That's the Financial District of London. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Do stay with us. Lots more coming up in the second half of the programme. We'll be returning to matters Ukraine in a few minutes' time, hearing from Moscow and about those returning to their homes close to the front lines. Do stay with us. Welcome back to NewsHour. A major international analysis of hundreds of studies of the use of all sorts of different pesticides has found that they are having a serious impact on biodiversity around the world and on all sorts of species. Dr. Ben Woodcock of the UK Centre for Ecology and Hydrology is co-author of the new research. It's published in the journal Nature Communications.
We've taken information from 1,700 studies everywhere across the globe and looked at the impacts of pesticides on over 800 species. Everything from microorganisms, fungi, plants, to insects, birds, mammals, amphibians, everything. So this is a really comprehensive assessment of what the consequences of pesticides are in the real world.
And what did you find then?
Overwhelmingly, we find that there are negative impacts. There's impacts on the growth of species, their reproduction, their behaviour, even at the molecular level, changes in the way that individual proteins may be synthesised within their cells. So there's a range of different effects going all the way from outright killing things to much more subtle things that might have an impact over a much longer timescale.
And it's not just other insects. This is all sorts of species, is it?
I think that's a really critical thing about this. This is going everywhere from bacteria all the way up to mammals and including insects and everything else in between. So it's really getting a good idea at that ecosystem level what the potential consequences are. And this is looking at species that are not considered to be a target for pesticides. And it's important to note that pesticides are intended to attack very specific things.
So collateral damage, if I can use that horrible phrase, how serious then is it for biodiversity? Are things worse than we thought?
There are global declines. You know, we know for insects, for example, that there is a decline in their abundance 10% annually. And we see declines across whole ranges of other groups. Now, there's a whole load of different things contributing to this. But the results that we show here strongly suggest that pesticides are one of those factors that are adding to that global biodiversity crisis.
The trouble is, farmers need to use pesticides, don't they, to maximise their yields and make sure that we have the crops that we need to feed ourselves. So is there an easy solution to this?
Yeah, if you stop pesticides tomorrow, the world would starve, farmer livelihoods would collapse. What is viable, however, is changes in the way that we focus the use of pesticides. If you apply pesticides a lot, pests become resistant to them. So there's a lot of things that can be done to actually reduce the usage. For example, breeding crops that might be resistant to pests, changing the time with which you sow seeds so you avoid when pests are prevalent, promoting parasitic insects or predatory insects, or using drones that can really pinpoint where a pest population is, rather than just spraying in general. So there's also issues with regulation as well. It's not very good at detecting very long-term, low-level exposure effects. And sometimes you get an interaction between two types of pesticides that can make one of them much more toxic.
And that was Dr. Ben Woodcock of the Centre for Ecology and Hydrology here in the UK. This is the BBC World Service in London. You're listening to NewsHour, and I'm James Menendez. Well, let's return to our top story. President Trump's announcement that peace talks with Russia over the war in Ukraine had already begun, but without Ukraine's involvement or that of America's European allies. It follows what we're told was a 90-minute phone call between Mr. Trump and Vladimir Putin. Steve Rosenberg's our Russia editor. Steve's in Moscow. So how is this all playing there?
Well, I mean, they're very, very pleased, I think, with what's been happening here. Russian state television has a daily political talk show, and it kicked off today with the host saying, sharp turn, historic shift, referring to this new US approach to Russia. Then President Putin's spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, gave his daily conference call for journalists. And I asked him how important was that telephone conversation between Trump and Putin. He said, very important conversation. He said Moscow and Washington had no contacts in the last few years. He claimed the Biden administration was hell-bent, he said, on making sure the war in Ukraine continued, but the new one wants to do everything to end it. So the Kremlin is pretty pleased. And I was reading the newspapers here this morning, and interesting, Izvestia had a political pundit saying, this puts a big full stop to Russia's so-called international isolation. I think that is the feeling here that, you know, for 3 years, Russia has faced this sort of tsunami of sanctions, thousands of international sanctions. Russia has seen attempts by the West to isolate Russia, to present the Russian president as an outcast. And now we see Donald Trump, the new US president, more than happy to pick up the phone and have a 90-minute conversation with Vladimir Putin and praise him. I mean, he said it in the comments that we saw Donald Trump post on social media yesterday. He said thank you to Vladimir Putin for the telephone call. He praised Vladimir Putin's common sense, and he said he was willing to work together with and closely with Vladimir Putin to end the war in Ukraine, a war which was started by President Putin 3 years ago with the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine.
And also suggesting a meeting between the two men in Saudi Arabia. And Vladimir Putin, of course, there's an arrest warrant out for him, issued by the International Criminal Court, on war crimes allegations.
Yes, I get the feeling we're living in a new world now, and that an arrest warrant from the ICC will not affect where Vladimir Putin goes. I mean, you know, yesterday when Putin and Trump were speaking on the phone, they invited each other to each other's countries. It was impossible to imagine, say a year ago, Vladimir Putin getting on a plane and flying to the United States when Joe Biden was president. But, you know, all bets are off now that Donald Trump is around. And I think the Russians are very confident with the way things are going. They're looking forward to meeting Donald Trump in Saudi Arabia, anywhere. Vladimir Putin has invited Donald Trump to Moscow. I wonder whether we'll see Donald Trump popping up on Red Square on May the 9th for the big Victory Day parade. You know, it'll be the 80th anniversary of the victory over Nazi Germany, a big thing here, big event. And some of the papers this morning here were suggesting, well, perhaps that's possible, you know, and that would mark a huge victory, I think, for Vladimir Putin, you know, if Donald Trump pitched up for Victory Day.
Our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg in Moscow. Millions of people in Ukraine were forced to leave their homes at the start of the full-scale Russian invasion 3 years ago. Many left for bordering countries, while others moved to places within Ukraine that were considered safer, such as the capital Kyiv and also the west of the country. Well, now some of these internal refugees want to go back, even to places close to the front line, places like Kramatorsk. BBC Ukrainian's Mariana Matvichuk has been to meet some of them.
The explosions that accompany Vita and her dogs on their walk are a reminder that war is close by. Vita lives in Kramatorsk, in eastern Ukraine, just 20 kilometers from the front line. She left 2 months after the start of the full-scale invasion, escaping just days before Russian rockets hit the city's train station. But now she is back and trying to recover some semblance of her former life. Vita's pet grooming salon is her pride and joy. As she comforts her first client of the day, a Yorkshire Terrier, she tells me how a missile landed close by and almost destroyed her business. But still, she wants to stay.
I returned to Kramatorsk because this is my home. I was born here. My parents were born here, and my grandparents lived here all their lives. Besides having a home, my work is here. I created it myself.
Vita couldn't settle in Kyiv, the city she escaped to. She found herself in a one-bedroom apartment with her daughter and 4 dogs. She says the financial help from the government was insufficient. And with no social connections to support her, she had no choice but to return to Kramatorsk. I've come to meet Andriy, a priest, who also chose to come back to Kramatorsk, despite the dangers. He's pointing out damage to his residential area. A huge hole in an apartment block shows where a glide bomb made impact. 10 people were injured, including 2 children. As a Protestant priest, Andriy would be targeted by Russians. In 2014, during the war in the east of Ukraine, he found himself on a Russian watch list. But he is willing to take the risk to stay and serve his local community, providing the kind of support Vita was missing in Kyiv.
People come here to receive psychological support. It's not only members of this church that visit. People from the whole area come because humanitarian aid has been distributed here for quite a long time. Children and young people spend time here too. They need attention because almost nothing is working in the city now. Public events are prohibited because it is dangerous to gather.
3/4 of Kramatorsk's population left when the full-scale invasion began. Less than 1/4 have since returned. Authorities in the region are trying to discourage more people from coming back while evacuating towns and villages where fighting is happening. Vadim Filashkin is governor of the Donetsk region. He meets me at the site of the glide bomb attack as workers try to fix the destruction.
Since the full-scale invasion, evacuation has been ongoing in the region. Forced evacuation is mandatory for children and families with children in areas where there is fighting. This region is the most dangerous in our country.
There is intense fighting along the front line. Millions of Ukrainians face a choice that Vita and Andriy do, whether to seek refuge in other parts of the country or stay in the places they consider home.
That was BBC Ukrainians Mariana Matvichuk reporting there from Kramatorsk in Ukraine. Now, the drug semaglutide seems to be everywhere. Marketed as Ozempic or Wegovy, it was developed to treat type 2 diabetes. But it's also had huge global success helping people to lose weight, essentially by controlling appetite. Anecdotally, some users have said that it's also helped curb their cravings for things like alcohol. Well, now that's been tested in a clinical trial. Let's talk to Dr. Clara Klein, assistant professor in the medicine department of the University of North Carolina in the US and lead researcher. Welcome to NewsHour. Tell us about your trial. What did you find?
Hi, thanks so much for having us. We looked at people who were described themselves as heavy alcohol users or heavy drinkers, and we randomized them to semaglutide or placebo and then measured how much alcohol they drank, both in a laboratory setting as well as what they reported. And we found that those that were randomized to semaglutide drank less alcohol, both during laboratory assessments, and then they had less heavy drinking days, and they also described less alcohol craving.
It was quite a small study, wasn't it?
Yes, it was quite a small study. And I think the important thing to take away from this study is that although it's incredibly exciting and very promising, this is a small study and it was it's preliminary. And we really need longer and larger clinical trials to determine the safety and efficacy in this setting.
And is the thinking that whatever it is in our bodies that controls our appetite also, I mean, that appetite doesn't just apply to food, it can also apply to things like alcohol?
Yeah, we think that these agents, you know, in terms of treating alcohol use and potentially substance use, it probably works in the brain. But the other mechanisms may also play a role, the things that, you know, that induce satiety. The mechanisms by which these agents work in this indication or may work in this indication need to be determined.
In terms of treating type 2 diabetes, I mean, it's been hugely successful, hasn't it?
Yes. You know, so I am an endocrinologist. I treat people living with diabetes and I treat weight management. And these agents have really revolutionized the way that we treat diabetes. They are just, you know, I can't even describe how amazing they are for people living with these conditions. And they have important cardiovascular disease benefits. They improve many, many metabolic profiles. So they really are amazing agents for those diseases. And we're just beginning to understand how they may impact other disease states. It's really an exciting time.
And I should say, yeah, your trial wasn't sponsored by the makers of semaglutide. It was the National Institute for Health. So what happens next? What bigger trials? And then one day, this could be something that doctors prescribe to those who have problems with alcohol abuse.
Yeah, I think that's the right question. I mean, we hope that there will be, you know, we are planning and we're hoping that there will be larger, longer trials with a variety of agents, not just semaglutide, but a variety of agents that are emerging and already available. So yes, I do hope and expect that there will be longer trials, larger trials with a variety of agents. And I think that, you know, that is very exciting because these have a wide reach. Treatments for alcohol use disorder aren't penetrating as well as they should be. And these drugs, you know, the incretin therapies, the medicines like Ozempic, you know, people are prescribing them readily. And so we have a good shot of reaching a lot of people.
Dr. Klein, thank you very much indeed. That was Dr. Clara Klein, assistant professor at the University of North Carolina at the medicine department there. This is James Menendez with NewsHour. Let's head back to Germany now, because the issue of immigration is a big concern for many voters going into the election at the end of next week. And a series of attacks blamed on asylum seekers, like the one today in Munich, has sharpened those worries even further. In turn, that seems to be helping the far-right Alternative for Germany, or AfD. It's predicted to win about 20% of the votes, a huge increase on the last election. And AfD supporters now come from a much more diverse mix of backgrounds, as our Europe editor Katja Adler has been finding out.
Alice Weidel. The crowd waving their German flags, Alice for Germany. Alice, 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 they're shouting like a rock star, even though she's dressed, as always, like a banker, which she once was.
Die AfD ist die Partei, die dieses Land wieder stark und stolz machen will.
This is the party that will make Germany proud and strong, she says.
Wir wollen, dass eure Kinder und eure Enkelkinder eine Zukunft haben.
She says, we're going to make sure, we in the AfD are going to make sure that your children and your grandchildren live in a safe country. So we have tried really hard to get an interview now with Alice Weidel. I mean, really hard, including at this event. And we have been told that she's far too busy to talk to us. But the crowd here had been really interesting, because the stereotypical image of an AfD voter is an older, angry white man from East Germany. We're in the West, and there are a lot of young women here, old women as well as younger men. I'm curious to ask some people why they felt it important to be here today. You're a young woman.
Yes.
What interests you in the AfD program?
Germany will be better than now. This is my hope. Familien sind nicht geschützt, man kann nicht mehr auf die Straße gehen.
You can't go out at night on the streets anymore. Migration needs to be more controlled.
Klar definiert sein.
Why are you here today?
Because I'm interested in seeing Alice Weidel and Tino Chrupalla. I never see them live, just in internet or YouTube.
We hear a lot about the AfD, that it has a very big social media presence. What is it that they do that's attractive for young people in social media?
I think we speak about the problems for the young people. A lot of young people have problems with immigrants and criminality.
Ich bin Journalistin von der BBC, also vom britischen Radio.
Nee, danke. Nein. Auch Lügenpresse, alles gut.
Lügenpresse, okay. I've just been dismissed as lying press by a woman I approached. Now, that's a phrase that dates back to Nazi times. I don't know if she is aware of that. I mean, the AfD has long felt shunned and resentful towards mainstream media. But I have to say, most supporters here have been really open with me today. And that is a sign the party is feeling a lot more confident. And that has to do with the majority of German voters being really preoccupied with core AfD themes, security and migration. I've now travelled to the southern German university town of Mannheim. I'm in the charming cobblestone main square of the old town, but what I'm looking at here is an informal memorial. Cards and flowers left here for a young policeman stabbed to death a few months ago by an Afghan asylum seeker. Other passers-by here were wounded as well, and that was just one of a string of attacks involving migrants in Germany over the past 10 months. The AfD are leafleting here today in Mannheim ahead of elections. Most people I'm speaking to here say security and migration are the things they're most worried about.
My name is Dominic, and I'm a father of four. I'm thinking about voting AfD because of the security situation in Germany. So many attacks in recent months. The AfD says it will control migration. Some people say the AfD is a Nazi party. But every party has some rotten apples in its ranks. I think maybe give them a chance to govern. Until then, we won't know who they really are.
If I'm out at night, policemen scold me. What are you doing out this late, old lady? You can't take safety for granted here anymore, you know. I am most interested in the AfD's economic and security policies.
Oh, yeah, but this is important because we are always, the people are saying, well, we are racist, this is nonsense, this is garbage.
Heinrich Koch is here. He's a local AfD politician and he insists the AfD is open to everyone, as long as they're law-abiding.
We had on our list German Sintis. And we're having people from Turkish migration, from Iran, from Hungary, from Poland, from Romania and so on.
So a car has just driven past this AfD stand shouting, Nazis raus, Nazis get out. They've driven into the parking lot, so I'm going to see if I can catch up with them. So you drove past?
Yeah.
And shouted. What did you shout?
We shouted Nazis out, so we don't want Nazis here.
I've been talking to this about them today. I mean, they say, we're not Nazis. We have no Nazis in our party. We're not extremists.
If you work in a party that openly discriminates people and is openly against democracy, then you're a part of this movement and then you are a Nazi. I'm sorry. With our backstory in Germany, you cannot say something like that.
Die schreien einfach nur. Sie haben unser Programm noch nie gelesen.
The two girls we were just talking to who accused the AfD of being Nazis, they're now engaging with them in a heated debate.
Bei ihnen stimmt was nicht. Tut mir leid.
This is so not German. I cannot tell you. I have covered politics in this country for years and years and years. Elections in this country are known to be dull, boring and predictable most of the time.
AfD! Partei des Kapitals! Sexistisch.
Remember the AfD rally with their Chancellor candidate Alice Weidel that started this report? While she addressed hundreds of supporters inside Heidenheim Concert Hall, this anti-AfD demonstration was going on outside, close by. Not too close. German police made sure of that to avoid clashes. Emotions are running high here. You can hear that. Voters for and these against the AfD each believe their country is in danger from the other. Now, larger political parties have pledged to exclude the AfD from any new government, but in a bid to boost their popularity, especially the conservative CDU, is aping AfD rhetoric on migration and security. And that is a win for the AfD, whatever happens next here.
North Europe editor Katy Adler reporting there from Germany. And our own James Kumarasamy will also be in Germany next week in the lead-up to the election and covering the election itself for us here on NewsHour. That's it for this edition of the programme. Thanks so much for listening. I'll be back tomorrow at the same time. Until then, bye-bye.